you be the judge. It says, you are welcome regardless of severity. Severity is in the eye of the sufferer, it says. Pain is pain. Crow's feet, birthmark, rhinoplasty that didn't take, mole, overbite, a bad hair year. The WYYY student engineer in his sulcus contemplates the moon, which looks sort of like a full moon that somebody's bashed in a little bit with a hammer. Madam Psychosis asks rhetorically whether the circulars left anyone out. The engineer finishes his fizzy and makes ready to descend again for the hour's close, his skin turned toward the terrible cerebral chill off the Charles, which is windy and blue. Sometimes Madam Psychosis takes one random call to start 60 minutes, more or less. Tonight, the one caller she ends by taking has a cultured stutter and invites MP and the YYY community to consider the fact that the moon, which of course, as any sot knows, revolves around the earth, does not itself revolve. Is this true? He says it is. That it just stays there, hidden, and disclosed by our round shadows rhythms, but never revolving. That it never turns its face away. The little Heathkit can't receive signals inside the cerebrum's subdural stairwells during descent, but the student engineer can anticipate she'll make no direct reply. Her sign-off is more dead air. She almost reminds the engineer of certain types in high school whom everyone adored because you sensed it made no difference to them whether you adored them. It had sure made a difference to the engineer, though, who hadn't been invited to even one graduation party with his inhaler and skin. The dessert Averill serves when Hal's over is Mrs. Clark's infamous high-protein gelatin squares, available in bright red or bright green, sort of like Jell-O on steroids. Mario's wild for them. CT clears the table and loads the dishwasher, since he didn't cook, and Hal gets into his coat at like, 101 hours. Mario's still listening to the WYYY nightly sign-off, which takes a while because they not only list the station's kilowattage specs, but go through proofs for the formulae by which the specs are derived. CT always drops at least one plate out in the kitchen and then bellows. Averill always brings some hell jello squares into Mario and adopts a mock dry tone and tells Hal it's been reasonably nice to see him outside Le Bâtiment Sanctifié. The whole thing to Hal sometimes gets ritualistic and almost hallucinatory, the post-prandial farewell routine. Hal stands under the big framed poster of Metropolis and whumps his gloves together casually and tells Mario there's no reason for him to leave too. Hal's going to blast down the hill for a bit. Averill and Mario always smile, and Averill asks casually what his plans are. Hal always whumps his gloves together and smiles up at her and says, make trouble. And Averill always puts on a sort of mock stern expression and says, do not, under any circumstances, have fun. Which Mario still always finds clutch your stomach funny, every time, week after week. Ennett House Drug and Alcohol Recovery House is the sixth of seven exterior units on the grounds of an Enfield Marine Public Health Hospital complex that, from the height of an ATH-SCME 2100 Industrial Displacement Fan, or Enfield Tennis Academy's hilltop, resembles seven moons orbiting a dead planet. The hospital building itself, a VA facility of iron-colored brick and steep slate roofs, is closed and cordoned, bright pine boards nailed across every possible access and aperture, with really stern government signs about trespassing. Enfield Marine was built during either World War II or Korea, when there were ample casualties and much convalescence. About the only people who use the Enfield Marine complex in a VA-related way now seem to be wild-eyed old Vietnam veterans in fatigue jackets, de-sleeved to make vests, or else drastically old Korea vets who are now senile, or terminally alcoholic, or both. The hospital building itself, stripped of equipment and copper wire, defunct, Enfield Marine stays solvent by maintaining several smaller buildings on the complex's grounds. Buildings the size of, like, prosperous homes, which used to house VA doctors and support staff, and leasing them to different state-related health agencies and services. Each building has a unit number that increases with the unit's distance from the defunct hospital and with its proximity along a rutted cement roadlet that extends back from the hospital's parking lot to a steep ravine that overlooks a particularly unpleasant part of Brighton, Massachusetts, Commonwealth Avenue, and its Green Line train tracks. Unit number one, right by the lot in the hospital's afternoon shadow, is leased by some agency that seems to employ only guys who wear turtlenecks. The place counsels wild-eyed Vietnam vets for certain very delayed stress disorders and dispenses various pacifying medications. Unit number two, right next door, is a methadone clinic overseen by the same Massachusetts Division of Substance Abuse Services that licenses Ennett House. Customers for the services of units number one and number two arrive around sunup and form long lines. The customers for unit number one tend to congregate in like-minded groups of three or four and gesture a lot and look wild-eyed and generally pissed off in some broad geopolitical way. The customers for the methadone clinic tend to arrive looking even angrier, as a rule, and their early morning eyes tend to bulge and flutter like the eyes of the choked. But they do not congregate, rather stand or lean along number two's long walkway's railing, arms crossed, alone, brooding, solo acts, standoffish. 50 or 60 people all managing to form a line on a narrow walkway, waiting for the same small building to unlock its narrow front door, and yet still managing to appear alone and standoffish, is a strange sight. And if Don Gately had ever once seen a ballet, he would, as an Ennett House resident, from his sunup smoking station on the fire escape outside the 5-man bedroom upstairs, have seen the movements and postures necessary to maintain this isolation in union as balletic. The other big difference between units number one and number two is that the customers of number two leave the building deeply changed, their eyes not only back in their heads but peaceful, if a bit glazed, but anyway, in general, just way better put together than when they arrived. While number one's wild-eyed patrons tend to exit number one, looking even more stressed and historically aggrieved than when they went in. When Don Gately was in the very early part of his Ennett House residency, he almost got discharged for teaming up with a bad news methadrine addict from New Bedford and sneaking out after curfew across the EMPHH complex in the middle of the night to attach a big sign on the narrow front door of Unit Number 2's methadone clinic. The sign said, "Closed until further notice. By order, Commonwealth of Massachusetts." The first staffer at the methadone clinic doesn't get there to open up until 0800 hours. And yet it's been mentioned how number two's customers always begin to show up with twisting hands and bulging eyes at, like, dawn to wait. And Gately and the speed freak from New Bedford had never seen anything like the psychic crises and near riot among these semi-ex-junkies. Pallid, blade-slender, chain-smoking homosexuals and bearded bruiser types in leather berets, women with mohawks and multiple sticks of gum in, upscale trust fund fritterers with shiny cars and computerized jewelry who'd arrived, as they'd been doing like hyper-conditioned rats for years, many of them, arrived at sunup with their eyes protruding and with Kleenexes at their noses and scratching their arms and standing on first one foot and then the other, doing basically everything but truly congregating, wild for chemical relief, ready to stand in the cold, exhaling steam for hours for that relief, who'd arrived with the sun and now seemed to be informed that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts was suddenly going to withdraw the prospect of that relief until, and this is what really seemed to drive them right over the edge out there in the lot, until further notice. Ape shit has rarely enjoyed so literal a denotation. At the sound of the first windowpane breaking and the sight of a blown-out old whore trying to hit a leather-vested biker with an old pre-metric grass grows by inches but it dies by feet sign from number two's clinic's pathetic front lawn, the methadrine addict began laughing so hard that she dropped the binoculars from the Ennett House upstairs fire escape where they were watching at like 0630 hours, and the binoculars fell and hit the roof of one of the Ennett House counselor's cars right below in the little roadlet, with a ringing clunk, just as he was pulling in. The counselor, his name was Calvin Thrust, and he was 4 years sober and a former NYC porn actor who'd gone through the house himself and now took absolutely zero in terms of shit from any of the residents, and his pride and joy was his customized vet, and the binoculars made rather a nasty dent, and plus they were the house manager's amateur ornithology binoculars, and had been borrowed out of the back office without explicit permission. And the long fall and impact didn't do them a bit of good, to say the least. And Gately and the methadrine addict got pinched and put on full house restriction and very nearly kicked out. The addict from New Bedford picked up the amanating needle a couple of weeks after that anyway, and was discovered by a night staffer simultaneously playing air guitar and polishing the lids of all the donated canned goods in the house pantry way after lights out, stark naked and sheened with meth sweat. Then after the formality of a urine, she was given the old administrative boot. Over a quarter of incoming Ennett House residents get discharged for a dirty urine within their first 30 days. And it's the same at all other Boston halfway houses. And the girl ended up back in New Bedford, and then within like 3 hours of hitting the streets, got picked up by New Bedford's finest on an old default warrant and sent to Framingham Women's for a 1-2 bit, and got found one morning in her bunk with a kitchen-rigged shiv protruding from her privates and another in her neck and a thoroughly eliminated personal map. And Gately's individual counselor, Jean M., brought Gately the news and invited him to see the methadrine addict's demise as a clear case of "There but for the grace of God goeth D.W. Gately." Unit number 3, across the roadlet from number 2, is unoccupied but getting reconditioned for lease. It's not boarded up, and the Enfield Marine Maintenance guys go in there a couple days a week with tools and power cords and make a god-awful racket. Pat Matassian hasn't yet been able to find out what sort of group misfortune number 3 will be devoted to servicing. Unit number 4, more or less equidistant from both the hospital parking lot and the steep ravine, is a repository for Alzheimer's patients with VA pensions. Number 4's residents wear jammies 24/7, the diapers underneath giving them a lumpy and toddlerish aspect. The patients are frequently visible at number 4's windows, in jammies, splayed and open-mouthed, sometimes shrieking, sometimes just mutely open-mouthed, splayed against the windows. They give everybody at Ennett House the howling fantods. One ancient retired Air Force nurse does nothing but scream, "Help!" for hours at a time from a second-story window. Since the Ennett House residents are drilled in a Boston AA recovery program that places great emphasis on asking for help, the retired shrieking Air Force nurse is the object of a certain grim amusement sometimes. Not 6 weeks ago, a huge stolen "Help Wanted" sign was found attached to number 4's siding right below the retired shrieking nurse's window. And number 4's director was less than amused and demanded that Pat Matassian determine and punish the Ennett House residents responsible. And Pat had delegated the investigation to Don Gately. And though Gately had a pretty good idea who the perps were, he didn't have the heart to really press and kick ass over something so much like what he'd done himself, when new and cynical, and so the whole thing pretty much blew over. Unit number 5, kitty corner across the little street from Ennett House, is for catatonics and various vegetable-ish, fetal-positioned mental patients subcontracted to a Commonwealth outreach agency by overcrowded LTIs. Unit number 5 is referred to, for reasons Gately's never been able to pinpoint, as the shed.
67.
It is understandably a pretty quiet place. But in nice weather, when its more portable inmates are carried out and placed in the front lawn to take the air, standing there, propped up and staring, they present a tableau it took Gately some time to get used to. A couple newer residents got discharged late in Gately's treatment for tossing firecrackers into the crowd of catatonics on the lawn to see if they could get them to jump around or display affect. On warm nights, one long-limbed, bespectacled lady who seems more autistic than catatonic tends to wander out of the shed wrapped in a bedsheet and lay her hands on the thin, shiny bark of a silver maple in number 5's lawn. Stands there touching the tree until she's missed at bed check and retrieved. And since Gately graduated treatment and took the offer of a live-in staffer's job at Ennett House, he sometimes wakes up in his staff cellar bedroom down by the payphone and tonic machine, and looks out the sooty ground-level window by his bed and watches the catatonic, touching the tree in her sheet and glasses, illuminated by Commonwealth Avenue's neon or the weird sodium light that spills down from the snooty tennis prep school overhead on its hill. He'll watch her, standing there, and feel an odd, chilled empathy he tries not to associate with watching his mother pass out on some piece of living room chintz. Unit number 6, right up against the ravine on the end of the rutted road's east side, is Ennett House Drug and Alcohol Recovery House. 3 stories of whitewashed New England brick, with the brick showing in patches through the whitewash, a mansard roof that sheds green shingles, a scabrous fire escape at each upper window, and a back door no resident is allowed to use, and a front office around on the south side with huge protruding bay windows that yield a view of ravine weeds and the unpleasant stretch of Commonwealth Avenue. The front office is the director's office, and its bay windows, the house's single attractive feature, are kept spotless by whatever residents get front office windows for their weekly chore. The mansard's lower slope encloses attics on both the male and female sides of the house. The attics are accessed from trapdoors in the ceiling of the second floor and are filled to the beams with trash bags and trunks, the unclaimed possessions of residents who've up and vanished sometime during their term. The shrubbery all around Ennett House's first story looks explosive, ballooning in certain unpruned parts, and there are candy wrappers and styrofoam cups trapped throughout the shrub's green levels, and gaudy homemade curtains billow from the second story's female side's bedroom windows, which are open what seems like all year round. Unit number 7 is on the west side of the street's end, sunk in hill shadow and teetering right on the edge of the eroding ravine that leads down to the avenue. Number 7 is in bad shape, boarded up and unmaintained and deeply slumped at the red roof's middle, as if shrugging its shoulders at some pointless indignity. For an Ennett House resident entering Unit Number 7, which can easily be entered through the detachable pine board over an old kitchen window, is cause for immediate administrative discharge, since Unit Number 7 is infamous for being the place where Ennett House residents who want to secretly relapse with substances sneak in and absorb substances and apply Visine and Clorets and then try to get back across the street in time for 23:30 curfew without getting pinched. Behind Unit Number 7 begins far and away the biggest hill in Enfield, Massachusetts. The hillside is fenced, off-limits, densely wooded and without sanctioned path. Because a legit route involves walking north all the way up the rutted road through the parking lot, past the hospital, down the steep curved driveway to Warren Street, and all the way back south down Warren to Commonwealth, almost half of all Ennett House residents negotiate Number 7's back fence and climb the hillside each morning, shortcutting their way to minimum-wage temp jobs at, like, the Provident Nursing Home or Schuco Mist Medical Pressure Systems, etc., over the hill up Commonwealth, or custodial and kitchen jobs at the rich tennis school for blonde, gleaming tennis kids on what used to be the hilltop. Don Gately's been told that the school's maze of tennis courts lies now on what used to be the hill's hilltop before the academy's burly, cigar-chomping tennis court contractors shaved the curved top off and rolled the new top flat, The whole long, loud process, sending all sorts of damaging avalanche-type debris, rolling down and all over Enfield Marines Unit Number 7, something over which you can sure bet the Enfield Marine VA administration litigated years back. But Gately doesn't know that ETA's balding of the hill is why Number 7 can still stand empty and unrepaired. Enfield Tennis Academy still has to pay full rent every month on what it almost buried. The 6th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. 16:10 hours, ETA weight room, freestyle circuits, the clank and click of various resistance systems. Lyle on the towel dispenser conferring with an extremely moist Graham Raider. Shocked doing sit-ups, the board almost vertical, his face purple and forehead pulsing. Trolch by the squat rack blowing his nose into a towel. Coyle doing military presses with a bare bar. Carol Spodek curling, intent on the mirror. Raider nodding as Lyle bends and leans in. Hal up on the spotter shelf in back of the incline bench in the shadow of the monster copper beach through the west window doing single-leg toe raises for the ankle. Ingersoll at the shoulder pull, steadily upping the weight against Lyle's advice. Keith, the Viking Freer, and the steroidic 15-year-old Elliot Cornspan spotting each other on massive barbell curls next to the water cooler's bench, taking turns, bellowing encouragement. Hal keeps pausing to lean down and spit into an old NASA glass on the floor by the little shelf.
68.
ETA trainer Barry Loach, walking around with a clipboard he doesn't write anything down on, but watching people intently and nodding a lot. Axford with one shoe off in the corner, doing something to his bare foot. Michael Pemulis, seated cross-legged on the cooler's bench just off Cornspan's left hip, doing facial isometrics, trying to eavesdrop on Lyle and Raider, wincing whenever Cornspan and Freer roar at each other.
Three more! Get it up there! Hoo-ah! Get that shit up there, man! It raped your sister! It killed your fucking mother, man! Do it!
Pemulis makes his face very long for a while and then very short and broad, then all sort of hollow and distended like one of Bacon's popes.
Well, suppose, Pemulis can just make out Lyle, suppose I were to give you a key ring with 10 keys, with 100 keys, and I were to tell you that one of these keys will unlock it, this door we're imagining opening in onto all you want to be as a player. How many of the keys would you be willing to try?
Trolch calls over to Pemulis.
Do the delint jerking off face again.
Pemulis for a second lets his mouth gape slackly and his eyes roll way up and flutters his lids, moving his fist.
Well, I'd try every darn one, Raider tells Lyle. Motherfucker! Fucker!
Pemulis's wince looks like a type of facial isometric.
Do Bridget having a tantrum? Too shocked in a stall?
Pemulis makes a shush finger. Lyle never whispers, but it's just about the same.
Then you are willing to make mistakes, you see. You are saying you will accept 99% error. The paralyzed perfectionist you say you are would stand there before that door, jingling the keys, afraid to try the first key.
Pemulis pulls his lower lip down as far as it will go and contracts his cheek muscles. Cords stand out on Freer's neck as he screams at Cornspan. There's a little hanging mist of spittle and sweat. Cornspan looks like he's about to have a stroke. There are 90 kilograms on the bar, which itself is 20 kilograms.
One more, you fuck! Fuck it, take it! Fuck me! Fuck me! You fuck! Take the pain!
Freer has one finger under the bar, barely helping. Cornspan's red face is leaping around on his skull. Carol Spodek's smaller bar goes silently up and down. Trulch comes over and sits down and saws at the back of his neck with a towel, looking up at Cornspan.
I don't think all the curls I've ever done altogether add up to 110, he said.
Cornspan's making sounds that don't sound like they're coming from his throat.
Yes! Yes!
Roars Freer. The bar crashes to the rubber floor, making Pemulus wince. Every vein on Cornspan stands out and pulses. His stomach looks pregnant. He puts his hands on his thighs and leans forward, a string of something hanging from his mouth.
Way to fucking take it, baby!
Freer says, going over to the box on the dispenser to get rosin for his hands, watching himself walk toward the mirror. Pemulus starts very slowly to lean over toward Cornspan, looking around confidentially. He gets so his face is right up near the side of Cornspan's mesomorphic head and whispers,
Hey, Elliot. Hey.
Cornspan, bent over, chest heaving, rolls his head a little his way. Pemulus whispers,
Pussy.
If, by the virtue of charity or the circumstance of desperation, you ever chance to spend a little time around a substance recovery halfway facility, like Enfield, Massachusetts, state-funded Ennett House, you will acquire many exotic new facts. You will find out that once Massachusetts Department of Social Services has taken a mother's children away for any period of time, they can always take them away again, DSS, like at will, empowered by nothing more than a certain signature-stamped form, that is, once deemed unfit, no matter why or when or what's transpired in the meantime, there's nothing a mother can do. Or, for instance, that people addicted to a substance who abruptly stop ingesting the substance often suffer wicked papular acne, often for months afterward, as the accumulations of substance slowly leave the body. The staff will inform you that this is because the skin is actually the body's biggest excretory organ, or that chronic alcoholics' hearts are, for reasons no MD has been able to explain, swollen to nearly twice the size of civilians' human hearts, and they never again return to normal size. That there's a certain type of person who carries a picture of their therapist in their wallet. That, both a relief and kind of an odd letdown, black penises tend to be the same general size as white penises on the whole. That not all U.S. males are circumcised. That you can cop a sort of thin, jittery, amphetaminic buzz if you rapidly consume 3 millennial fizzies and a whole package of Oreo cookies on an empty stomach. Keeping it down is required, however, for the buzz, which senior residents often neglect to tell newer residents. That the chilling Hispanic term for whatever interior disorder drives the addict back again and again to the enslaving substance is tecatogusano, which apparently connotes some kind of interior psychic worm that cannot be sated or killed. That black and Hispanic people can be as big or bigger racists than white people, and then can get even more hostile and unpleasant when this realization seems to surprise you. That it is possible, in sleep, for some roommates to secure a cigarette from their bedside pack, light it, smoke it down to the quick, and then extinguish it in their bedside ashtray, without once waking up and without setting anything on fire. You will be informed that this skill is usually acquired in penal institutions, which will lower your inclination to complain about the practice, or that even flints, industrial-strength expandable foam earplugs, do not solve the problem of a snoring roommate if the roommate in question is so huge and so adenoidal that the snores in question also produce subsonic vibrations that arpeggio up and down your body and make your bunk jiggle like a motel bed you've put a quarter in. That females are capable of being just as vulgar about sexual and eliminatory functions as males. That over 60% of all persons arrested for drug and alcohol-related offenses report being sexually abused as children, with two-thirds of the remaining 40% reporting that they cannot remember their childhoods in sufficient detail to report one way or the other on abuse. that you can weave hypnotic Madame Psychosis-like harmonies around the minor D scream of a cheap vacuum cleaner, humming to yourself as you vacuum, if that's your chore. That some people really do look like rodents. That some drug-addicted prostitutes have a harder time giving up prostitution than they have giving up drugs, with their explanation involving the two habits' very different directions of currency flow. That there are just as many idioms for the female sex organ as there are for the male sex organ. That a little-mentioned paradox of substance addiction is that once you are sufficiently enslaved by a substance to need to quit the substance in order to save your life, the enslaving substance has become so deeply important to you that you will all but lose your mind when it is taken away from you. Or that sometime after your substance of choice has been taken away from you in order to save your life, as you hunker down for required AM and PM prayers, you will find yourself beginning to pray to be allowed literally to lose your mind, to be able to wrap your mind in an old newspaper or something and leave it in an alley to shift for itself without you. That in Metro Boston, the idiom of choice for the male sex organ is unit, which is why Ennett House residents are wryly amused by EMPH Hospital's designations of its campus's buildings. That certain persons simply will not like you no matter what you do. Then, that most non-addicted adult civilians have already absorbed and accepted this fact, often rather early on. That no matter how smart you thought you were, you are actually way less smart than that. That AA and NA and CA's God does not apparently require that you believe in him, her, it before he, she, it will help you.
69.
That, pace macho bullshit, public male weeping is not only plenty masculine but can actually feel good, reportedly. That sharing means talking, and taking somebody's inventory means criticizing that person, plus many additional pieces of recovery speak. That an important part of Halfway House human immunovirus prevention is not leaving your razor or toothbrush in communal bathrooms. That apparently a seasoned prostitute can, reportedly, apply a condom to a customer's unit so deftly he doesn't even know it's on until he's history, so to speak. That a double-layered steel portable strongbox with tri-tumblered lock for your razor and toothbrush can be had for under $35 US, or $38.50 ONAN via HomeNet Hardware. And that Pat M., or the house manager, will let you use the back office's old TP to order one, if you put up a sustained enough squawk. That over 50% of persons with a substance addiction suffer from some other recognized form of psychiatric disorder, too. That some male prostitutes become so accustomed to enemas that they cannot have valid bowel movements without them. That a majority of Ennett House residents have at least one tattoo. That the significance of this datum is unanalyzable. That the Metro Boston street term for not having any money is sporting lint. That what elsewhere is known as informing or squealing or narking or ratting or ratting out is, on the streets of Metro Boston, known as eating cheese, presumably spun off from the associative nexus of rat. That nose, tongue, lip, and eyelid rings rarely require actual penetrative piercing. This is because of the wide variety of clip-on rings available. That nipple rings do require piercing, and that clitoris and glans rings are not things anyone thinks you really want to know the facts about. That sleeping can be a form of emotional escape, and can, with sustained effort, be abused. That female Chicanos are not called Chicanas. That it costs $225 US to get a Massachusetts driver's license with your picture but not your name. That purposeful sleep deprivation can also be an abusable escape. That gambling can be an abusable escape too. And work, shopping and shoplifting, and sex and abstention and masturbation and food and exercise and meditation slash prayer, and sitting so close to Enid House's old DEC TP cartridge viewer that the screen fills your whole vision and the screen's static charge tickles your nose like a linty mitten.
70.
That you do not have to like a person in order to learn from him, her, it. That loneliness is not a function of solitude. That it is possible to get so angry you really do see everything red. What a Texas catheter is. That some people really do steal, will steal things that are yours. That a lot of U.S. adults truly cannot read, not even a ROM hypertext phonics thing with help functions for every word. That clicky alliance and exclusion and gossip can be forms of escape. That logical validity is not a guarantee of truth. That evil people never believe they are evil, but rather that everyone else is evil. That it is possible to learn valuable things from a stupid person. That it takes effort to pay attention to any one stimulus for more than a few seconds. That you can, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, want to get high with your substance so bad that you think you will surely die if you don't, but can just sit there with your hands writhing in your lap and face wet with craving, can want to get high but instead just sit there, wanting to but not, if that makes sense. And if you can gut it out and not hit the substance during the craving will eventually pass. It will go away, at least for a while. That it is statistically easier for low IQ people to kick an addiction than it is for high IQ people. That the Metro Boston street term for panhandling is stemming, and that it is regarded by some as a craft or art, and that professional STEM artists actually have like little professional colloquia sometimes, little conventions, in parks or public transport hubs at night, where they get together and network and exchange feedback on trends and techniques and public relations, etc. That it is possible to abuse OTC cold and allergy remedies in an addictive manner. That NyQuil is over 50 proof. That boring activities become, perversely, much less boring if you concentrate intently on them. That if enough people in a silent room are drinking coffee, it is possible to make out the sound of steam coming off the coffee. That sometimes human beings have to just sit in one place and, like, hurt. That you will become way less concerned with what other people think of you when you realize how seldom they do. That there is such a thing as raw, unalloyed, agendaless kindness. That it is possible to fall asleep during an anxiety attack. That concentrating intently on anything is very hard work. That addiction is either a disease or a mental illness or a spiritual condition, as in poor of spirit, or an OCD-like disorder, or an affective or character disorder, and that over 75% of the veteran Boston AAs who want to convince you that it is a disease will make you sit down and watch them write disease on a piece of paper and then divide and hyphenate the word so that it becomes dis-ease. Then will stare at you as if expecting you to undergo some kind of blinding epiphanic realization, when really, as G. Day points tirelessly out to his counselors, changing disease to dis-ease reduces a definition and explanation down to a simple description of a feeling, and rather a whiny, insipid one at that. That most substance-addicted people are also addicted to thinking, meaning they have a compulsive and unhealthy relationship with their own thinking. That the cute Boston AA term for addictive-type thinking is analysis paralysis. That cats will, in fact, get violent diarrhea if you feed them milk, contrary to the popular image of cats and milk. That it is simply more pleasant to be happy than to be pissed off. That 99% of compulsive thinkers' thinking is about themselves. That 99% of this self-directed thinking consists of imagining and then getting ready for things that are going to happen to them. And then, weirdly, that if they stop to think about it, that 100% of the things they spend 99% of their time and energy imagining and trying to prepare for all the contingencies and consequences of are never good. Then, that this connects, interestingly, with the early sobriety urge to pray for the literal loss of one's mind. In short, that 99% of the head's thinking activity consists of trying to scare the ever-living shit out of itself. That it is possible to make rather tasty poached eggs in a microwave oven. That the Metro Street term for really quite wonderful is pisser. That everybody's sneeze sounds different. That some people's moms never taught them to cover up or turn away when they sneeze. That no one who has been to prison is ever the same again. That you do not have to have sex with a person to get crabs from them. That a clean room feels better to be in than a dirty room. That the people to be most frightened of are the people who are the most frightened. That it takes great personal courage to let yourself appear weak. That you don't have to hit somebody even if you really, really want to. That no single individual moment is, in and of itself, unendurable. That nobody who's ever gotten sufficiently addictively enslaved by a substance to need to quit the substance and has successfully quit it for a while and been straight and but then has for whatever reason gone back and picked up the substance again has ever reported being glad that they did it, used the substance again, and gotten re-enslaved. Not ever. That bit is a Metro Boston street term for a jail sentence, as in,
Don G was up in Billerica on a 6-month bit.
That it's impossible to kill fleas by hand. That it's possible to smoke so many cigarettes that you get little white ulcerations on your tongue. That the effects of too many cups of coffee are in no way pleasant or intoxicating. That pretty much everybody masturbates. Rather a lot, it turns out. That the cliche, I don't know who I am, unfortunately turns out to be more than a cliche. That it costs $330 US to get a passport in a phony name. That other people can often see things about you that you yourself cannot see, even if those people are stupid. That you can obtain a major credit card with a phony name for $1,500 US, but that no one will give you a straight answer about whether this price includes a verifiable credit history and line of credit for when the cashier slides the phony card through the register's little verification modem, with all sorts of burly security guards standing around. That having a lot of money does not immunize people from suffering or fear. That trying to dance sober is a whole different kettle of fish. That the term VIG is street argot for the bookmaker's commission on an illegal bet, usually 10%, that's either subtracted from your winnings or added to your debt. That certain sincerely devout and spiritually advanced people believe that the God of their understanding helps them find parking places, and gives them advice on Massachusetts lottery numbers. That cockroaches can, up to a certain point, be lived with. That acceptance is usually more a matter of fatigue than anything else. That different people have radically different ideas of basic personal hygiene. That, perversely, it is often more fun to want something than to have it. That if you do something nice for somebody in secret, anonymously, without letting the person you did it for know it was you or anybody else, know what it was you did, or in any way or form trying to get credit for it, it's almost its own form of intoxicating buzz. that anonymous generosity, too, can be abused. That having sex with someone you do not care for feels lonelier than not having sex in the first place afterward. That it is permissible to want. That everybody is identical in their secret unspoken belief that way deep down they are different from everyone else. That this isn't necessarily perverse. That there might not be angels, but there are people who might as well be angels. That God, unless you're Charlton Heston, or unhinged, or both, speaks and acts entirely through the vehicle of human beings, if there is a God. That God might regard the issue of whether you believe there's a God or not as fairly low in his, her, its list of things she, he, it's interested in re-you. That the smell of athlete's foot is sick sweet versus the smell of podiatric dry rot is sick sour. That a person, one with the disease or dis-ease, will do things under the influence of substances that he simply would not ever do sober, and that some consequences of these things cannot ever be erased or amended.
71.
Felonies are an example of this, as are tattoos. Almost always gotten on impulse, tattoos are vividly, chillingly permanent. The shopworn, act in haste, repent at leisure, what seemed to have been almost custom designed for the case of tattoos. For a while, the new resident, Tiny Ewell, got first keenly interested and then weirdly obsessed with people's tattoos, and he started going around to all the residents and outside people who hung around Ennett House to help keep straight, asking to check out their tattoos and wanting to hear about the circumstances surrounding each tattoo. These little spasms of obsession, like first with the exact definition of alcoholic, and then with Morris H.'s special Toll House cookies until the pancreatitis flare, then with the exact kinds of corners everybody made their bed up with. These were part of the way Tiny E temporarily lost his mind when his enslaving substance was taken away. The tattoo thing started out with Tiny's white-collar amazement at just how many of the folks around Ennett House seemed to have tattoos. And the tattoos seemed like potent symbols of not only whatever they were pictures of, but also of the chilling irrevocability of intoxicated impulses. Because the whole thing about tattoos is that they're permanent, of course, irrevocable once gotten. Which, of course, the irrevocability of a tattoo is what jacks up the adrenaline of the intoxicated decision to sit down in the chair and actually get it, the tattoo. But the chilling thing about the intoxication is that it seems to make you consider only the adrenaline of the moment itself, not, in any depth, the irrevocability that produces the adrenaline. It's like the intoxication keeps your tattoo-type class person from being able to project his imagination past the adrenaline of the impulse, and even consider the permanent consequences that are producing the buzz of excitement. Tiny Ewell will put this same abstract but not very profound idea in a whole number of varied ways, over and over, obsessively almost, and still fail to get any of the tattooed residents interested. Although Bruce Green will listen politely. And the clinically depressed Kate Gompert usually won't have the juice to get up and walk away when Tiny starts in, which makes Ewell seek her out vis-a-vis tattoos, though she hasn't got a tattoo. But they don't have any problem with showing Tiny their tats. The residents with tats don't, unless they're female, and the thing is in some sort of area where there's a boundary issue. As Tiny Ewell comes to see it, people with tattoos fall under two broad headings. First, there are the younger, scrofulous, boneheaded, black t-shirt and spiked bracelet types, who do not have the sense to regret the impulsive permanency of their tats, and will show them off to you with the same fake, quiet pride with which someone more of Ewell's own social stratum would show off their collection of dynastic crockery or fine Sauvignon. Then there are the more numerous and older second types, who'll show you their tattoos with a sort of stoic regret, albeit tinged with a bit of self-conscious pride about the stoicism, that a purple-hearted veteran displays toward his old wounds' scars. Resident Wade McDade has complex nests of blue and red serpents running down the insides of both his arms, and is required to wear long-sleeved shirts every day to his menial job at Store 24, even though the store's heat always loses its mind in the early a.m., and it's always wicked motherfucking hot in there, because the store's Pakistani manager believes his customers will not wish to purchase Marlboro Lights and Massachusetts Gigabucks lottery tickets from someone with vascular-colored snakes writhing all over his arms.
72.
McDade also has a flaming skull on his left shoulder blade. Dooning Glynn has the faint remnants of a black dotted line tattooed all the way around his neck at about Adam's apple height, with instruction manual-like directions for the removal of his head and maintenance of the disengaged head tattooed on his scalp from the days of his skinhead youth, which now the tattooed directions take patience and a comb and three of April Cortelieu's barrettes for Tiny Even to see. Actually, a couple of weeks into the obsession, Ewell broadens his dermotaxonomy to include a third category, bikers, of whom there are presently none in Ennett House, but plenty around the area's AA meetings, in beards and leather vests and apparently having to meet some kind of weight requirement of at least 200 kilos. Bikers is the Metro Boston street term for them, though they seem to refer to themselves usually as scooter puppies, a term which, Ewell finds out the hard way, non-bikers are not invited to use. These guys are veritable one-man tattoo festivals, but when they show them to you, they're disconcerting because they'll bear their tats with the complete absence of affect of somebody just showing you like a limb or a thumb, not quite sure why you want to see or even what it is you're looking at. A like NB that Ewell ends up inserting under the heading biker is that every professional tattooist, everybody who can remember getting their tattoos remembers getting them from, was, from the sound of everybody's general descriptions, a biker. With regards to the stoic regret group within Ennett House, it emerges that the male tattoos with women's names on them tend, in their irrevocability, to be especially disastrous and regretful, given the extremely provisional nature of most addicts' relationships. Bruce Green will have Mildred Bonk on his jilted right triceps forever. Likewise, the Doris in red-dripping Gothic script just below the left breast of Emil Minty, who, yes, apparently did love once. Minty also has a palsied and amateur swastika with the caption, "Fuck niggers," with one G, on a left biceps he is heartily encouraged to keep covered as a resident. Chandler Foss has an undulating banner with a redly inscribed Mary on one forearm. Said banner now mangled and necrotic because Foss, dumped and badly coked out one night, tried to nullify the romantic connotations of the tat by inscribing Blessed Virgin above the Mary with a razor blade and a red Bic, with predictably ghastly results. Real tattoo artists, Ewell gets this on authority after a white flag group meeting from a biker whose triceps tattoo of a huge disembodied female breast being painfully squeezed by a disembodied hand, which is itself tattooed with a disembodied breast and hand, communicates real tattoo credibility, as far as Tiny's concerned. Real tat artists are always highly trained professionals. What's sad about the gorgeous violet arrow-pierced heart with Pamela incised in a circle around it on Randy Lentz's right hip is that Lentz has no memory either of the tattoo impulse and procedure or of anybody named Pamela. Charlotte Treat has a small green dragon on her calf and another tattoo on a breast she set a boundary about letting Tiny see. Hester Thrail has an amazingly detailed blue and green tattoo of the planet Earth on her stomach, its poles abutting pubis and breasts, an equatorial view of which caused Tiny 2 weeks of doing Hester's weekly chore. Overall searing regret honors probably go to Jennifer Belbin, who has 4 uncoverable black teardrops descending from the corner of one eye, from one night of masculine and adrenalized grief, so that from more than 2 meters away, she always looks like she has flies on her, Randy Lentz points out. The new black girl, Dee Dee N, has on the plane of her upper abdomen a tattered screaming skull, off the same stencil as McDade's, but without the flames. That's creepy because it's just a tattered white outline. Black people's tattoos are rare, and for reasons Ewell regards as fairly obvious, they tend to be just white outlines. Ennett House alumnus and volunteer counselor Calvin Thrust is quietly rumored to have on the shaft of his formerly professional porn cartridge performers unit a tattoo that displays the majuscule initials CT when the unit is flaccid and the full name Calvin Thrust when hyperemic. Tiny Ewell has soberly elected to let this go unsubstantiated. Alumna and VC Danielle Steenbach once got the bright idea of having eyeliner-colored tattoos put around both eyes, so she'd never again have to apply eyeliner, not banking on the inevitable fade that over time turned the tattoos a kind of nauseous, dark green she now has to constantly apply eyeliner to cover up. Current female live-in staffer, Jeanette Fultz, has undergone 2 of the 6 painful procedures required to have the snarling orange and blue tiger removed from her left forearm, and so now has a snarling tiger minus a head and 1 front leg, with the ablated parts looking like someone determined has been at her forearm with steel wool. Ewell decides this is what gives profundity to the tattoo impulse's profound irrevocability. Having a tat removed means just exchanging one kind of disfigurement for another. There are Tingley and Deal's identical palmate cannabis leaf on inner wrist tattoos, though Tingley and Deal are from opposite shores and never crossed paths before entering the house. Nell Gunther refuses to discuss tattoos with Tiny Ewell in any way or form. For a while, Tiny Ewell considers live-in staffer Don Gately's homemade jailhouse tattoos too primitive to even bother asking about. He'd made a true pest of himself, though, Ewell did, when at the height of the obsession, this one synthetic narc-addicted kid came in who refused to be called anything but his street name, Skull, and lasted only like 4 days, but who'd been a walking exhibition of high regret ink, both arms tattooed with spiderwebs at the elbows, on his fishy white chest a naked lady with the same kind of over-lush measurements Ewell remembered from the pinball machines of his Watertown childhood. On Skull's back, a half-meter-long skeleton in a black robe and cowl, playing the violin in the wind on a crag with The Dead in maroon, on a vertical gonfalonish banner unfurling below. On one bicep's either an ice pick or a mucronate dagger, and down both forearms a kind of St. Vitus's dance of leather-winged dragons with the words on both forearms, "How do you like your blue-eyed boy now, Mr. Death?" The typos of which, Tiny felt, only served to heighten Skull's whole general Tat-Gestalt's intended effect, which Tiny presumed was primarily to repel. In fact, Tiny E's whole displacement of obsession from bunks hospital corners to people's tattoos was probably courtesy of this kid Skull, who on his second night in the newer male residence, 5-man room, had shed his electrified muscle shirt and was showing off his tattoos in a boneheaded, regretless, first-category fashion to Ken Erdetti, while R. Lentz did headstands against the closet door in his jockstrap, and Ewell and Jeffrey D. had their wallets, credit cards spread out on Ewell's drum-tight bunk and were trying to settle a kind of admittedly childish argument about who had the more prestigious credit cards. Skull flexing his pectorals to make the overdeveloped woman on his chest writhe, reading his forearms to Erdetti, etc. And Jeffrey Day had looked up from his Amex, gold to Ewell's platinum, and shaken his moist, pale head at Ewell, and asked rhetorically, what had ever happened to good old traditional U.S. tattoos like mom or an anchor, which for some reason touched off a small obsessive explosion in Ewell's detox-frazzled psyche. Probably the most poignant items in Ewell's survey were the much-faded tattoos of old Boston AA guys who've been sober in the fellowship.